I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a Friday conversation with Stephen King about the best new short stories. But first, former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto today blamed Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants for the bombings in Pakistan yesterday that left up to 136 people dead. No group has claimed responsibility, and Bhutto's husband told Pakistan television he thinks government forces might have been involved. Two explosions went off in Karachi yesterday as about 150,000 people gathered to welcome Bhutto back after her eight-year self-imposed exile in London and Dubai. Shahan Mufti of the Christian Science Monitor just left Karachi. He joins us on a scratchy line from Islamabad, but we really appreciate it. Shahan, we know you haven't slept in 2 days. Can you describe what it was like in Karachi in the aftermath of these bombings?
The scenes were horrific. I did go to Jinnah Hospital, which was one of the two hospitals where all the dead and injured and maimed were being brought in, and I mean, obviously it's hard to describe those scenes, but there was just lines of ambulances, a whole chain of ambulances that was just coming in for hours after the bombing had gone off. So maybe 3 or 4 hours even after the bomb had gone off, the bombs had gone off, there were ambulances pouring into the hospital. There were people coming in on taxis, on two-wheelers, on auto rickshaws, any way they could, and the families mourning outside, and also political party activists who were chanting political slogans through this all and were very angry and frustrated.
Well, Shahan, what was your sense of security there? Because Bhutto said today she wasn't going to blame the government, but she had questions about why the lights had gone out on the parade route, why the phone line seemed to be out. Some ministers in Musharraf's government were saying, why did she take so long, 8 to 10 hours, on this slow-moving parade route that she made herself a target? So what was your sense of security there?
Well, when I went in there, the word security nightmare just kept ringing in my head. This was an absolute, like you said, hundreds of thousands of people from all over, from every corner of Pakistan, had congregated onto one major thoroughfare in Karachi. There was no way that I could see that it was being controlled, who could come into this procession and who could be part of it, and what they could bring in. People were carrying backpacks, people were carrying bags, all sorts of things. And people had come in on buses with their own belongings from interior Sindh or Balochistan. The scale of this, and then we're talking about Karachi, which is, quite frankly, one of the most lawless cities in this country.
Isn't that where Daniel Pearl was kidnapped and killed?
This is the city that Daniel Pearl was kidnapped in, and it's the city with the highest crime rate in this country.
Well, Benazir Bhutto today in her press conference, as we said, accused several terrorist groups. But Taliban militants have told the AP they weren't behind the attacks. And you would think that since they had threatened her prior to the trip, they'd be eager to claim credit if they did do these bombings. So what is the sense of who was responsible? Where did she, Bhutto, get her information?
It's obviously very difficult to say where anybody is getting any of this information from. The logical consensus would be that the people who had threatened Benazir Bhutto were the ones who had actually carried out the attacks. Benazir Bhutto did initially come out very strongly against the government for not taking enough security measures and not providing enough security. That was toned down a little in this press conference today. Yeah. But still, there is a possibility that People's Party and Benazir will take the government to task instead of going after the perpetrators of this attack.
Well, given that, Shahan, what happens going forward? There was a sense that her retirement, there might be a power-sharing deal with current President Musharraf, upcoming elections. Is there a sense that people will campaign after the bombing? So what do you see going forward?
This does raise a few questions about the elections. If this is how lax security is, and if these suicide bombings, is a very new phenomenon in Pakistan. Pakistanis are not used to this sort of violence at all. There's been about 12 suicide bombings this year alone, which is far beyond anything that this country had ever seen. It does raise a lot of questions as far as how secure are people going to be if some people decide that they do not want to see an election in Pakistan and decide to use these tactics. And so this obviously has huge political implications, and also then it opens the possibility that if the law and order situation in this country deteriorates to a certain level, then that would allow the president to declare an emergency and maybe even martial law.
Shahan Mufti is with the Christian Science Monitor. He's been speaking to us from Islamabad, having just returned from Karachi, where, of course, two bombings took place, marring the return of Benazir Bhutto to Pakistan. Shahan, thanks so much for your time. Well, we often turn this time on Friday over to an author to hear about his latest work. Today, an author talking about other people's work. Not that Stephen King doesn't have enough of his own. He loves to write 60 books, hundreds of short stories, but he also loves to read. He promotes other authors in a column for Entertainment Weekly, and this year, he took the job of guest editor for the 2007 edition of Best American Short Stories, with his co-editor Heidi Pittler sorting through hundreds of contenders that multiplied like Mickey Mouse's brooms and the Sorcerer's Apprentice. And we have to ask, was this a dream job or the kind of nightmare that, well, Stephen King would write about? They managed to narrow the field down to 20 terrific stories, and Stephen King joins us in the studio for a look at them and the state of writing in general. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And so the news is the short story, alive and well, but hard to find.
Well, it's alive. I don't know if you could actually say it's well. The magazines that still carry them are a little bit tougher to find than they used to be, but the stories that I read, a lot of them were just dynamite.
Well, when you say they're hard to find, I just want to, you know, now they're compiled, the very best are compiled, but you paint this picture at the beginning of the book of yourself, you know, sort of on your belly, crawling along in bookstores, trying to find these magazines.
Right. They're magazines with titles like Tin House, American Zoetrope, which is published by Francis Ford Coppola, The Kenyon Review Plowshares, which is done out of Emerson College here in Boston, mm-hmm. Glimmer Train, Alaska Quarterly. Iowa Review. Yeah, there are probably 120 to 140 magazines, but it's not like in the days when I grew up where the Saturday Evening Post would pay $1,000 for a short story. A lot of times, if there's pay for these things at all, it's like maybe $80, and a contributor would spend that much sending copies to their relatives.
Isn't that something? When, as we read the, you know, the very best that have been collected here, they are astonishing. It's like these people are from another planet.
Yeah, it's a treasure trove. When you pick the book up, every story is a winner.
Well, let's talk about some of them. St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves is by Karen Russell. This is the idea that a pack of girls, and boys actually, but we focus on the girls, was raised by werewolves, and then they're civilized in a convent.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about what caught your ear on this.
The thing that I like about it is that it's true. It's about wolf girls who were put in a convent and raised and socialized and civilized. But what it really is a kind of a parable for what we put our own children through, particularly the girls, to turn them from little savages into the sort of grown-up, neurotic creatures that they eventually become. Right. That's what we call civilization, and that's the wonderful joke of the story.
Here's Karen Russell's opening line. At first, our pack was all hair and snarl and floor-thumping joy. We forgot the barked cautions of our mothers and fathers, all the promises we'd made to be civilized and ladylike, couth and kempt.
Yeah.
And then they tear at their hair. They are on all fours, and they're made mm-hmm. to put on shoes and stand up. It's
yeah,
quite
they,
something.
They have a litany that they have to go through every day. Knees together, shoes on feet. Knees together, shoes on feet.
I kind of have that myself.
Sure. Well, that's the point of the story. Right. I think that any girl who grew up would be able to tell similar stories.
Right. Let's move on to one of yours. I know you have maybe a couple lines you might read from Toga Party by John Barth. It begins as a simple sort of humorous tale of a couple attending a party.
The story starts like this. If Doc Sam Bailey, Dick Felton's longtime tennis buddy from over in Oyster Cove, were telling this Toga Party story, the old ex-professor would most likely have kicked it off with one of those lefty liberal rants that he used to lay out for his Heron Bay friends and neighbors at the drop of any hat. It's got that kind of almost classical feel to it, and yet the story is very, very modern, about a bunch of old people who get together at a Roman costume party, and there's a little bit too much to drink, and one of them starts to mourn his dead wife and actually tries to commit suicide in the Roman fashion. But the real point of the story is what happens afterward to one couple that's witness to this. And the story, a lot of these stories just run a spectrum from humor to horror, all in the same story. And you really get a feel for an art that's becoming lost, because we tend to concentrate more on the novel nowadays. Those are the books that people read. But these are perfect little miniatures where a great many emotions are expressed in a short span of pages.
you write in your book on writing, use the active voice, not the passive voice. And that had a very direct, forward, he did this, this person did this. Explain to us more, what do you mean active voice versus passive voice?
Well, in the active voice, the subject is doing something, and in the passive voice, something is being done to the subject of that sentence. And I think a lot of times, writers will try to convey a sense of authority and a sense of I'm in charge of this particular piece of writing by using the passive voice. So they'll say something like, it is to be hoped that the person will do thus and such, instead of saying, boy, I really hope you'll do this,
yes,
which is the direct, straight way to do it. And the thing about the short story is that it almost demands the active voice. The short story is a very difficult discipline to master because everything has to be in a tiny space. And for that, the active voice is perfect.
You can't have any fat on it.
That's it.
Yeah. Another example you give in your book, the rope was thrown by the writer. No. The writer threw the rope.
Right.
Yeah. Take out the ings, too, the ings.
That's right. Yeah. Let's get to it.
Yeah, get to it. All right, well, let's get to another story. Wake by Beverly Jensen.
For me, it is a perfect New England story, the sort of story that almost any family would tell at a family get-together about this funeral where everything possible goes wrong. May I read the beginning
please,
of this
please,
story?
Yeah.
This is wonderful. But you have to do it in the right accent. You have to get that Down East accent. Good God Almighty, we've lost the damn body. Ava stood on the North Station train platform, her small leather suitcase pressed between her knees, as though it, too, might be whisked away. Dalton, we've lost Dad. What the hell are we going to do? And it's got that feel of a down-home told story instead of a written story. And the sad thing is that this is the only story Beverly Jensen ever published, and it was published posthumously. She died at 49, and these stories were left as part of her estate.
Okay, well, that's Beverly Jensen's Wake. Again, one of the 20 top short stories in the new edition, which is edited by writer Stephen King. Does it support the writers?
It does support the writers, and the money is secondary at this point to the street cred. Okay, you get in this book, it helps you sell more short stories, because when you send more stories out, you can say, well, I published thus and such in Best American Stories. But the thing is, I've met some of the younger writers, Karen Russell for one, Randy DeVita for another. I asked these young writers, to a man and to a woman, are you working on a novel? And they all say yes, because that's the next logical step. From the short stories, where you practice and perfect your craft, to the novel.
Stephen King. And when we come back, more of his thoughts on writing. And was that him caught on camera reading a book during a Red Sox game? First quick note, later in the show, we're going to check in on the Values Voter Summit to see if conservative Christians follow through on their threat to pick a third-party candidate. That's later, but we'll be back with Stephen King in just 1 minute, here and now. We've been talking about writers and writing with Stephen King, who, along with Heidi Pittler, edited the new collection, The Best American Short Stories 2007. And Stephen King, let's keep going. Another story in the collection, Sans Farine by Jim Shepherd, is one of the most extraordinary. It's the fictional account of a young executioner in France, of a family, a long line of executioners during the Revolution and after. He tells of how awful the burden and responsibility is, how he helped in the shift from, boiling people to designing the guillotine. How did Shepherd think of writing about this?
Where do you guys get your ideas? You know, Sans Farine is an amazing story in the sense that it kind of made an impression in a way a lot of short stories don't these days. I started to hear from everybody, whoa, did you see that story in Harper's, Sans Farine? My son Owen mentioned it. My other son, who's also a writer, Joe, he mentioned it. So it was there, and I read it. It just knocked me out.
What was it about the writing? Because the writing is glorious. What was it about the word usage that knocked your socks off?
I thought that it was particularly good because I think that Shepherd used a lot of the actual history and a lot of the mythological history. And the nice thing about fiction is you can mix those two things wildly and come up with your own story. So he used a lot of fact, he used a lot of received wisdom in the story, and he combined it with a really flat delivery. Listen to this.
Go.
The executioner's role in the proceedings consisted of giving a little tug on a lever. The crowd saw the blade, but not the hand that moved it. Much time was consumed afterwards with the mess. And that's what I mean about flat. That last sentence is perfectly flat. Much time was consumed afterwards with the mess. And by the way, it's the passive voice. But again, rules were made to be broken. And there it works because it's so flat and so dry.
Here's another one. Our youngest boy, Gabriel, fell when exhibiting one of the heads, fracturing his skull and dying before my eyes.
Yeah.
What? there's that. A couple more of your rules from writing, which again, are as you said, are made to be broken. Adverbs not your friends.
No, the adverb is definitely not your friend.
Use in a sentence, please. I mean, give us an illustration.
Well, let's see. What can I say? As he sat in the radio studio, studiously answering her questions, okay? So we don't really need studiously. I'm sitting there, and I'm answering your questions. What's studiously doing in that sentence? It's just occupying space, and that's the case in most sentences.
Well, you know, and we go through this here a lot when we're writing. Is it because, you know, you suspect in that sentence the writer didn't trust the sentence? He felt, I need to put in words so you will know that this is a good sentence.
But that's the case with every bad choice that any writer ever made in a piece of fiction or a piece of nonfiction. When you read a bad sentence, it's because the writer didn't trust himself and said, I don't think I'm getting through to you. I've said in On Writing, and I say it all the time, writing is telepathy. Something's in my head. I write a bunch of little symbols on a page, and you get what it was that I was thinking about, even if it's 200 years later down the line. I'm dead and gone, you're alive, yet we still have that mind-to-mind communication. We know it isn't perfect, and so a lot of times people will say, well, I need to inject a little steroid into this, and that's really what an adverb is. Mm. It's a literary steroid that's sort of meant to pump things up a little bit.
You say good writing is letting go of fear and affectation, and it feels to me like when I see affectation, it's probably fear.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the in a lot of ways, I think it's very bad for writers and would-be writers to imitate Hemingway because it just leads over a cliff after a while. But if you study his sentence structure, it's all there. The clarity is there. He writes in Big Two-Hearted River, Nick came to the river, period. The river was there, period. It's perfect communication. We know everything we need to know.
Who else do you read, Stephen King, because you're avaracious? And you tell young writers, read a lot and write a lot. Who to read?
Well, whenever anybody asks me a question like that, I have a kind of mental circuit shutdown because I read as many people as I can. I'm reading a wonderful book now by William Gay called Twilight. And the style would be a little bit familiar to people who read Cormac McCarthy. Cormac McCarthy leads to Hemingway. But on the other side of the street, working the other side, the kind of stripped and clean side, I've always just sort of revered James M. Cain, who in The Postman Always Rings Twice just pares down his sentences so that you have a novel that in somebody in less skilled hands, it would be a 350-page novel. His, it's 128. So from James M. Cain, you can even jump to somebody like Elmore Leonard, who has some of that same vibe. So there are a lot of great people out there. And, you know, unlike TV, no commercials, and you're in charge of the entertainment. When you read something scary, you never have to worry about seeing the zipper up the monster's back because it's your mind. Like radio.
Stephen King, one last question for you. It seems as if you are always promoting another writer. Even at your beloved Red Sox games, we're watching in the playoff games on a Friday night, and the camera kept going. You show up to a lot of the games. And there you were, and the camera would pan, and there's this guy reading in the stands. And finally they figure out, hey, wait, that's Stephen King, and he's reading. And what were you reading?
Well, I was reading a really wonderful book by Robert Harris, who wrote the novel Fatherland. This one's called The Ghost. It's about a ghostwriter. It was terrific. And if you saw me reading at the game, I can guarantee you one thing. You saw me on a tape, because I never read during the game. The idea about taking a book to the game is this. There are 9 innings in a big league baseball game, which means there are 18 breaks when the team switch sides and the pitcher warms up. In those breaks, under ordinary circumstances, you can read 18 pages of a book. You can read a page each time the half inning ends while the teams are getting ready to go out and do the other thing, because otherwise you're just sitting there in your seat twiddling your thumbs, so you might as well multitask.
Or here in Boston singing Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline.
Only in the 8th inning, thank God.
Well, I hope it catches on. What a fabulous thing it would be if people were reading.
And remember, in a postseason game, when one of the networks picks it up, you can read 2 pages between innings because the breaks are longer.
We've been talking writers and writing with Stephen King, editor of The Best American Short Stories 2007. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And by the way, Monday, author Shalom Auslander, he rejected his fundamentalist orthodox upbringing, and he's still trying but failing to reject God. That's Monday. Still ahead today, wonder how gospel singer Marie Knight would feel about that. She's up as well after the news here and now. Thousands of Christian conservatives are gathered in Washington for what's being called the Values Voter Summit. It's a conference organized by the Family Research Council to give the 2008 Republican presidential candidates a chance to do what none of them has done so far, win over the evangelical bloc of the Republican Party. In fact, national leaders such as Focus on the Family founder James Dobson have threatened to support a third-party candidate if pro-choice Rudy Giuliani is the GOP nominee. But speaking at the conference today, Ohio Congresswoman Jean Schmidt said Republicans must be united, especially if Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee.
I really want to speak to how important it is that we stand behind whatever candidate that will be her rival, whether we agree with all of their opinions and values or not.
Connie Mackey is Senior Vice President for the Legislative Arm of the Family Research Council. She joins us from the Values Voters Summit. And Connie, we've heard how unhappy conservatives are about the candidates. And a month ago, leaders met in Salt Lake City and threatened fielding a third-party candidate. So what is the feeling there today?
Well, you know what? The feeling is you've got a real mixed bag, except for the fact that Giuliani doesn't seem to fit the bill, although there are many conservatives who are pro-life who would support Giuliani.
Let's start with Giuliani. Your president, Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, has said he believes that Rudy Giuliani is Hillary's ticket to the White House. I'm quoting him here. He said this on CNN. A pro-abortion candidate such as Rudy Giuliani would absolutely drive the core base, the evangelicals and conservatives in the Republican Party, away, and Hillary would win. But others have said that you have to sort of put aside those differences on issues like abortion because Giuliani is leading in the polls.
Well, you know, I totally agree with Tony Perkins, because people who were looking for a candidate, a well-rounded candidate that would represent not only national security and lower taxes, but also the cultural candidate, they will simply grab the remotes, turn on the TV, and they will not go to the polls. You don't have to bother with a third party if Giuliani is the candidate. In other words, if you had a third party, obviously the candidate's not going to win. It would simply derail the Republican Party. Giuliani will derail the Republican Party no matter what, because as more is known about him from people across the country, they will simply not go to the polls, and you'll have the same effect.
How does your opinion reflect the thinking of others who are meeting this weekend? Do you think there will be a push for a third party candidate at all?
I don't.
No.
I don't.
Let's look at some of the other candidates who will be speaking to you this weekend. What does candidate Mitt Romney have to say to allay fears of the evangelical base about his faith?
I think that he has said an awful lot. I mean, obviously, he has made a conversion, it seems, to the issues that we care about.
Well, let me ask you about that. You say he's moved towards you on issues like abortion and gay marriage. Others call that flip-flopping. Has that concern been pushed aside?
I think that flip-flopping is this. Look, when a liberal, moves toward, liberal issues, it's called growing. You're closer to the Washington Post, and that's welcome. Now you've got a guy that's moved towards the conservative thought process, and it's not flip-flopping unless he flip-flops back to where he was before, as far as I'm concerned. So right now we've had a conversion that we have to trust but verify.
So those issues you know, as you said, the jury's sort of out, but it's not negative for Romney right now.
No, if I'm hearing you correctly. Don't believe it is.
Right.
Look at you had Bob Jones University, endorse him recently. I think that's a pretty loud, vote from the evangelical community.
Actually, it wasn't that loud. It wasn't a very enthusiastic endorsement. Let me read it. This is Bob Jones III. He's the chancellor of the Christian University in South Carolina. He said, "I'd rather endorse someone whose religion is wrong than someone who doesn't have any religion at all."
Well, I didn't realize what the words were, but it was taken as an endorsement. So, my point stands.
Yeah. And just staying with his faith for a moment, only because you are a faith-based meeting,
Right.
We've discussed here some of the tenets of the Mormon faith, a different image of Jesus Christ, different image of the afterlife. In the Mormon faith, are you going to ask Mitt Romney at any point to get specific about some of those things, or no?
No, because the freedom of religion still stands in this country, and I think some of the leaders of different evangelical and Catholic organizations have all said we're not electing a pastor, we're electing a president of the United States. So I think that will take care of a lot of people with concern, but I wouldn't say for a minute that there won't be those who absolutely could not pull the lever for him because of his faith.
A couple other candidates. Fred Thompson, your president, Tony Perkins, has said, I think he has a lot to offer in the field of candidates. Your sense of Fred Thompson, who hasn't, to some people, he hasn't voiced the things they want to hear. There hasn't been an energy behind the message.
There certainly hasn't been any energy there, which I think has surprised a lot of people who were looking to the Thompson campaign to sort of coalesce behind. And the lack of energy has been astonishing. So we'll look to see if he can pump it up today.
And John McCain, Tony Perkins says on John McCain's faith, and this was to MSNBC in October, he seems to have a difficulty in discussing it in terms that people relate to. And his stance on abortion is questionable.
I think Tony regretted that particular statement because McCain does have 25 years of good, solid pro-life votes behind him. We've got a problem with his votes as it comes to the biotech issues. And as far as John McCain having a problem, discussing his faith, a lot of people do not like to discuss their faith, and I don't think people will hold that against him. He's done other things that people in the conservative community have a big problem with, like McCain's Feingold, but he deserves a good look at this conference, and I think he'll get it.
Well, Connie Mackey, again with the Family Research Council, it sounds like you, and I extrapolate that perhaps the council, that you're leaning towards Mitt Romney.
No, actually, It's not that we're not, but it's not that we are. What I would say is that it is still wide open.
Yeah. And is it possible that you might, after all is said and done, turn to each other and say, let's try for 2012? Or do you think you will pick one of the candidates we see now?
You didn't mention one candidate who I think is getting a lot of buzz, and that is Huckabee.
This is former Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas. Mm-hmm.
That's right. He's incredibly articulate. He is getting a lot of notice around the halls of this hotel.
Because, tick off the couple reasons, he is a sort of a standard bearer for your issues?
A standard bearer, yes, but I don't think anybody expected someone to come out and be more articulate than the people that have been in the forefront of the political world. And he, frankly, has just outshined some of the people, I won't name which one in particular, but at various functions where several of them would speak, and the buzz comes out that Huckabee was incredible. So what that means and what that amounts to, I don't know, but I'm just, you're asking for the flavor of the or the atmosphere around here, and I would say that Huckabee is definitely one of the top people are talking about.
Connie Mackey, Senior Vice President for FRC Action, that's the legislative arm of the Family Research Council, speaking to us from the Values Voters Summit in Washington, which kicks off today, goes through the weekend. Connie, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin. Bye-bye.
And by the way, another favorite of the group is expected to announce he will not be running for president today. That's Senator Sam Brownback. So his hat is being withdrawn from the ring. Well, still to come before the hour's up, 80-something Marie Knight. Next week, she's going to be inducted into Gospel's Hall of Fame. You're listening to Here and Now. Let's see. anything happen in sports last night? Ah, yes, behind the pitching of Josh Beckett, the Boston Red Sox kept their playoff hopes alive, beating the Cleveland Indians 7-1 and forcing a Game 6 in the American League Championship Series, which Cleveland leads 3-2, but who cares? Here to talk baseball and more is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Let's get it all out on the table. Because, you know, we're here in Boston. You know, less listeners think we've loaded the deck here.
I know what you're going to say.
I'm an unabashed Sox fan, but let's see, who predicted that the Indians would win the series?
I had the Indians winning, and I'm so smart, Robin, that I had the Indians winning because their two starting pitchers were pitching better than Boston's two best starting pitchers. And Josh Beckett has made an idiot of me in that regard. Cleveland does lead the series, as you pointed out, 3-2, but it's hardly thanks to CC Sabathia, and we will find out on Saturday night whether their second best starting pitcher, Fausto Carmona, can pitch any better than he did the first time around. He was awful.
Well, but I mean, Cleveland has won 3 games.
Absolutely.
Handily, so we should say that. And I have a soft spot for Fausto Carmona, the Cleveland pitcher, because he gave my nephew a ball last Saturday night at the game here at Fenway Park.
And you're going to root against him anyway.
No, him, I'll just sort of go, okay, you know, I'll give him a little sort of, he was very nice, and he's a terrific pitcher. But, you know, another amazing performance, as you said, from Josh Beckett last night. He allowed just 1 run, 5 hits, striking out 11 in 8 innings. When they come back to Fenway Park, though, who have they got? Who's going to be pitching for the Sox?
Well, Schilling in Game 6, and he's no slouch as an October pitcher either, as
we
you
think
remember.
Bloody sock.
Yeah, I think the only real problem, the thing that Red Sox fans may have to worry about, is it is 3 years later, he's 3 years older, and the indications have been that he's kind of trying to be a crafty pitcher these days rather than a power pitcher, and he's gone a lot of years being a power pitcher successfully. So Red Sox fans have to hope that he will be able to dig down and find some of the Curt Schilling of old for at least one more game.
And we should say, we mentioned Fausto Carmona, and on Sunday, Cleveland is expected to start Jake Westbrook.
Yeah, this is what has made me, so smart, is that the pitchers whose names I didn't even know before the series began have been the ones who have pitched well for Cleveland.
Okay, meanwhile, the National League champs, the Colorado Rockies, they haven't played baseball since, I think, last July, it feels like, actually since they swept the Arizona Diamondbacks back on October 15th. Sorry, mm-hmm. Arizona. The World Series doesn't get underway until Wednesday. So since they've had so much time off, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Two schools of thought on that, of course. On the one hand, their pitchers, both starters and relievers, will be thoroughly rested, and everybody who had a sore muscle or a bruise or something like that will have had lots of time to recover from it. On the other hand, when you win 21 games out of 22, the last thing you want to do is stop playing baseball. You want to play doubleheaders every day when things are going your way to the extent that they have been for the Rockies. So we'll see whether the magic that they have generated over the last month or so continues to prevail.
Okay, hit it, Doug.
Take this job and shut.
Yesterday, Joe Torre turned down Yankee owner George Steinbrenner's 1-year, $5 million contract offer to keep managing the team. What happened there?
I think it's a dumb decision. All Joe Torre has done is get the Yankees to the playoffs for 12 consecutive years. You can't do too much more than that. Now, granted, they haven't won the World Series in a while, but still, to get there and to be playing in October, that's quite an achievement.
So you think this is a slap in the face?
Oh, absolutely.
But some people thought he was going to be fired.
Well, they all but fired him. They tried to fire him. They tried to fire him without actually firing him. They cut his salary. They attached incentive clauses to his contract. You don't do that to a man who's been managing as long as Joe Torre has. And they knew very well when they offered him this contract that he would not accept it. Okay. There was no surprise there.
All right. Well, Bill Littlefield covers sports and so much more every week on NPR's Only a Game. After this weekend, we'll know who'll be playing the game of baseball next week in the series. And, you know, we're just going to say, let the best team win.
That seems reasonable.
No, we're not. Go Red Sox.
I knew you wouldn't say that. It seemed reasonable to me.
Go Red Sox. Here's the Dropkick Murphys' Tessie. That's the song that we sing here in Boston to get them going. And good luck to everybody. Still to come, speaking of prayers, gospel singer Marie Knight after a break here now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Next week in Detroit, the International Gospel Hall of Fame will induct 9 new members, including singer Marie Knight. It's about time. Marie Knight began singing with the internationally known gospel superstar Sister Rosetta Tharpe back in the 1940s. Marie went on to record R&B in the 50s, then fast forward to 2002, when producer Mark Carpentieri was putting together a tribute to Sister Rosetta Tharpe and tracked Marie down. Mark put Marie's version of Didn't It Rain on the Rosetta Tharpe tribute album, but he also produced Marie's new album, her first in over 20 years, Let Us Get Together, a tribute to Reverend Gary Davis. And that brings us to today.
Let us get together right down here. Let us get together right down here.
We spoke with Marie Knight recently. She said, hey, maybe we weren't hearing her, but she never stopped singing.
Oh, yes, I haven't stopped. I've been around over the country, out of the country, back in, you know, for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. And on the road since 1939, I heard in one of your DVDs that you started out by, as a little girl, standing on a table and singing for people.
Yes.
You'd stand on the table and sing this song, Doing All the Good We Can, 6 or 7 years old. Do you remember what that felt like?
Oh, well, it felt like it was very exciting, because the people were looking and some were reaching and whatnot, but it was very exciting.
Well, and then onward to singing with Sister Rosetta Tharpe. We've profiled Sister Rosetta Tharpe on the program. There's a terrific biography, Shout, Sister, Shout, by Gail Wald. Sister Rosetta Tharpe did rock and roll before Elvis, was a gospel star who could sell out stadiums. She would always be dressed to the nines. What was your impression of her when you sang with her?
Oh, Rosetta, to me, was one of the greatest artists that was ever around. Because I guess it's because she discovered me. She gave me what everything she had.
How did she discover you? Were you singing at the time? Or?
No, I was at a church in New York, and she happened to be there in the audience. She came to my house and asked my mother, could she take me on the road? Mom said yes, and that was it.
That was it. You said at one point in your act, when you sang together, you were saint and sinner, and you were the sinner.
I was the sinner, yeah.
What does that mean?
She would be on one side of the stage, and she would come up with the intro to the song, and I had a little half-torn mandolin, and I would come up with the wrong key and the wrong everything, not the song she was singing or nothing. She'd say, listen, can't you get the gig together? I said, yeah, I'm going to be there after a while. She said, yeah, they're going to be out after a while.
Well, as we said, producer Mark Carpentieri rediscovered you to record Didn't It Rain on a tribute to Sister Rosetta Tharpe. He also came up with the idea of you doing your own tribute CD. It's called, as we said, Let Us Get Together. And this is a tribute performing the songs of Reverend Gary Davis, the blind Gary Davis, as he was known, the Harlem street singer, a renowned guitarist. But do I understand that you'd never heard of him?
I never heard of him. I never knew him.
Isn't that something?
But see, the songs that he had began to sing and began to play, they're very touching. And with the way it was recorded, the way Mark came up with the recording session was simply beautiful.
Hmm. Let's listen to a little more. This is called I'll Fly Away, a song that's been recorded a number of times.
Been recorded quite a few times.
Yeah.
Just a few more weary days and then I'll know I'll fly away to my home where joy will never end. I'll fly away.
Your thoughts about that song?
It has a history. There's a history in the song. When you just sit and listen to it, it's really a history, because that day is going to come where you're going to disappear. And when you think about it, you say, oh, I wonder, is it tomorrow? Could be.
Well, you know, I'm thinking you better than anyone knows that, because I was so sorry to read that while you were traveling once, while you were on the road singing, both your mother and your two children burned to death in a fire. Was it in New Jersey? It was back east.
Yes, yeah. That took a lot out of me. I was down for over a year because I had to fly in from California to that.
Oh, man.
And I didn't get a chance to see the bodies or nothing because they were already closed, one of those things. But I just lived it. I lived it so many days until it wasn't even funny.
I bet.
I was on the road. Things happen to me when I'm on the road. Death don't have no mercy in this land. He'll come to your house and he won't stay long. You look in the bed and somebody will be gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land.
It would seem like a predictable answer, but I'm wondering if, you know, in that year after, you know, so many losses, did you turn away from the music or turn to it?
No, I turned to it. I just wanted to go and sing. I just didn't want to stay one particular place. Just move out and sing. You see, singing is my life.
How much is singing the faith? Is the faith? I know you're a preacher, right? Like the Reverend Gary Davis. Could you have the faith without the singing? You know, are they hand in hand?
No, it goes together. Because if you're trying to think, if you can't, the preacher that can't sing, he's got to get somebody that can.
So you're a reverend, and as we said, you're now recording the songs of another reverend, the Reverend Gary Davis. He wrote Samson and Delilah, which Peter, Paul, and Mary recorded. Let's listen to your version.
Delilah was a woman. She was fine and fair. She had good looks, God knows, and cold black hair. Delilah, she gained no Samson mind. At first he saw the woman at the Philistine.
By the way, your voice sounds great. Really?
Got a cold now.
Well, no, it sounds great. I guess it's 60-something years of singing, starting on that little table. Is there anything you do? Anything do you do voice exercises, or is it just...
No, I don't drink. I don't hang out late at night. I don't smoke cigarettes. And when I feel like eating, I eat. I try to eat the right food, but... When I'm in the city, you know, by support with different groups and whatnot that I travel with, they understand that.
I feel Lord, that going on.
Is it a new time for you? Or is it, I'm wondering if maybe you're just Marie Knight and, you know, as things change around you, you don't care. You just kind of go straight ahead.
Well, as things go, I go along with the time. Because when it comes to singing, comes to music, backs and forth, and I know the difference in it. And I say, well, maybe I can do that song, or maybe I can't. It's one of those things. I go along with the time. Because, as I said before, singing is my life.
Lord, I feel, hey, that going on.
That's gospel singer Marie Knight. Her new CD is Let Us Get Together, a tribute to Reverend Gary Davis. The guitarist on the CD, by the way, is Larry Campbell. Marie Knight will be inducted into the Gospel Hall of Fame next week, and she's wrapping up a tour tonight in North Adams, Massachusetts. So for more on that, go to our website, here-now.org. And while you're there, don't forget you can download a podcast.
Lord, I feel like going on. Oh, I feel.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. We know the Lord is way too busy to be thinking about baseball, so we'll just say, go Sox. Join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.